I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Diplomacy in the Middle East was dramatically altered last week when U.S. President Bush gave his near unconditional support to a plan proposed by Israel's prime minister. Ariel Sharon says he's ready to pull Israelis out of Gaza, but he wants to keep certain other settlements in the West Bank. And he wants an end to the Palestinian right of return for refugees. Bush agreed, acknowledging that his position was a fundamental change in long-held U.S. policy, but insisting that he hopes it will help break the deadlock in the region. Well, within a couple of days, news of the U.S. support for Israel's plan was overtaken by another high-profile assassination in Gaza. The new head of Hamas, Abdelaziz Rantisi, was killed by an Israeli missile attack. Coming so close on the heels of the Bush meeting, the killing is being seen in much of the Arab world as something sanctioned by the U.S. From much of the rest of the world, it brought more direct criticism for Israel. Today, we look at just what has changed. Was it time for the U.S. to shed its neutrality to pick a side in one of the world's most notorious and deadly conflicts? Do you think that the region is made even more dangerous now that the U.S. has effectively thrown its support behind Israel's prime minister? And what do you think the past week's events mean for a two-state solution, still possible as Bush claims, or off the table for good? Our number is 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to have you join us this hour. We're going to start our coverage with James Bennett. He is New York Times correspondent based in Jerusalem, and he's joining us on the line. Hello, James.
Hi.
I wonder if I can start back with the meeting between President Bush and Prime Minister Sharon. The decision by the Bush administration to, in effect, say yes, yes, yes to the Sharon proposals. How was that seen by Israelis?
Israelis welcomed it and generated new support for Prime Minister Sharon as he tries to push forward his plan to unilaterally withdraw from the Gaza Strip without any kind of peace agreement with the Palestinians. The element that was particularly welcomed, I think, by Israelis was President Bush's declaration for the first time that Palestinian refugees of the Israeli-Arab War of 1948 and their descendants would not be able to exercise what they call a right of return to what is now Israel. Israelis overwhelmingly feared that that claimed right was simply an effort by the Palestinians to do by demography what they couldn't do by force of arms, which is to wipe out the state of Israel. And Palestinians regarded that as one of their key, at least as one of their key negotiating levers, and they fear that now President Bush has effectively taken that away.
All right, so we were only 2 days into trying to make sense of that when the killing of the Hamas leader made headlines over here. Abdelaziz Rantisi killed within a month of the killing of Sheikh Ahmed Yassin in much the same way. And tell me how that was being viewed by Israelis as well, if you would, James.
Israelis are accustomed to this policy of conducting these so-called targeted killings against Hamas leaders, Gaza Strip and in the West Bank. They've been going after these guys for at least a year, these Hamas, so-called Hamas political leaders. In fact, the man who was killed this weekend, Abdelaziz Rantisi, was subjected to a failed attempted killing last June. So Israelis now take this almost as a matter of course. They overwhelmingly support the government's policy, even though, interestingly enough, polls suggest that most Israelis don't consider it an effective strategy. That is, they think it increases terrorism in the short run and may not even decrease it in the long run. But they support it simply because they're so angry at these people, I think.
And the Palestinian reaction to it was considerably loud and angry and threatening. But as I watched that, James, I was thinking to myself, we watched almost exactly the same reaction when Sheikh Ahmed Yassin was killed a month or so ago. There's an almost ritual nature to that kind of fury being expressed on the streets of Gaza City. How do we see it beyond that?
There is a kind of ritualistic quality to it, but I don't think that in any way should diminishes the very real anger that's being expressed. There was a slightly newer enhanced element this time, I think, which is a greater component of anger at the United States because this strike came on top of the previous strike on Sheikh Yassin and came just a couple of days after Ariel Sharon was meeting in Washington with President Bush. Palestinians concluded that President Bush gave Mr. Sharon permission, essentially, to conduct this strike. The Americans deny that they had any forewarning it was going to happen. But the Palestinians, factoring all these things together and seeing it as evidence of an American tilt toward Israel, is leaving them essentially a victims of American policy.
And when you look in some kind of long term, James, at the way that President Bush has altered the U.S. role here in I'm hesitating to use the words the peace process, because there's not a lot of peace that's being talked about. But has the U.S. really changed the balance in a way that we're going to be talking about months from now, years from now?
Yes, I mean, there's no question we're going to be talking about it. What exactly we're going to be talking about, though, I think is impossible to predict. Things are in motion here in a way they haven't been in many years, and in a way that I think makes very hard for anybody to judge what the outcome will be. The Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, who was the architect of Israel's settlement policy, has now pretty much locked up support on his right wing for the first time for the idea of actually dismantling settlements in the Gaza Strip and a few of them in the West Bank. In doing this, he's trying to hold on to as much of the West Bank as he can, but nevertheless, it's setting a precedent for the evacuation of settlements if he actually proceeds with it. I think the Bush administration is gambling that Mr. Sharon is starting a process whose endpoint he may not be able to judge or to assure, that this process might carry him further than he means to go. Might in the end result in some sort of peace process.
So just one quick last point, James. Does it mean that Ariel Sharon needs to continue to demonstrate his ability to flex military power in that area as a way of bringing the right wing along?
There's a very complicated dynamic going on. Yeah, the short answer to that question is yes. I mean, to reassure his right-wing supporters in Israel that he's not buckling essentially to terrorism, running from a fight in Gaza, this sort of strike is very helpful, although his people are very quick to say that political considerations do not factor into it. They do say that there is a connection to the withdrawal plan, however, because they say that Hamas and other militant organizations in the Gaza Strip are seeking to portray this withdrawal as a victory for them. And in order to support that claim, they're trying to carry out sensational attacks. So the Israelis say they're trying to prevent Hamas from essentially claiming victory here as the Israelis depart.
James, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
James Bennett is Jerusalem Bureau Chief for The New York Times. We're going to go to Cairo now. Mustafa Al-Sayed's joining us now on the line. He is a professor of political science at Cairo University. Mustafa, it's nice to have you back on the program.
Thank you very much.
Tell me what people in Cairo are saying about this news today.
I think, you know, people in Cairo are very angry at what happened. I'm reading Egyptian newspapers, and one of the opposition newspapers, in fact, is describing the demonstrations which took place yesterday in most Egyptian universities, in Cairo, Alexandria, Mansoura, Suez Canal University, Munufia, Santa. Egyptian workers also condemned this crime. second assembly, the upper house in the Egyptian parliament, the Shura Council, also is asking parliaments of the world to interfere in order to stop what it called Israel's criminal actions. The Arab Lawyers Union is calling for a strike in order to express Arab discontent at this.
Mustafa, I wonder if I can interrupt you for just a minute, because I had one specific question that puzzled me, and that was last week President Bush welcomed Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak to the ranch in Crawford. They met with reporters. They met alone together discussing issues in the Mideast, and I would have thought, based on that meeting, that perhaps some of the interests or that you're describing would have been a part of the American equation. But only a day or so later, then we had Mr. Bush in effect agreeing with all aspects of the plan proposed by the Israeli Prime Minister. Where does Mr. Mubarak, where do the Arab leaders fit in this picture?
Yeah, I think President Mubarak said that he was shocked when he knew of the American statement. I think he was told of this statement by Secretary Colin Powell after he had the press conference with President Bush. So I don't think he was informed in advance of what the U.S. was going to say to the Israelis. And I think he said it on more than one occasion that he was shocked, and that this statement by the U.S. is going to engender acts of violence in Arab countries. My understanding of this is that really President Bush does not care at all about the position of governments friendly to the U.S. in the region, and he has only his election campaign in mind when he takes such a decision. And I think this is the only consideration.
It's also been suggested, Mustafa, that the I think we've lost that connection to Cairo. We'll see if we can reestablish that in a couple of moments. I'm lucky, though, that we have Bill Emmett joining us now from Bill is editor of The Economist and joining us from his magazine studio there in London. Is that right?
That's right. Good morning.
Sorry, Bill. I'm scrambling with my notes here. Thanks for that. You've been listening in to what what Mustafa has had to say about this event. I'm wondering if you can give me a broader picture of how Europe is reacting, because I have several pages of notes here from morning papers around the world. And there's a lot of condemnation of the Israel decision to strike the second Hamas leader. And I'm wondering how that factors into a longer term view of what's going on in that region.
Well, I think that James Bennett got it right when he said that things are in motion, but we don't know quite in what direction they're going and where it's going to end up. And that's, I think, a feeling that's being felt in Europe as well. There was initial condemnation last week by a lot of European leaders of President Bush's agreement with Ariel Sharon, but not, of course, by my own Prime Minister, Tony Blair. Then there has been condemnation of the killing of the Hamas leader. But I would say it's been muted. It's not been really very sustained. I think there's a sense among European leaders that they don't really see a lot of upside in condemning these things very aggressively, but also because they're not really quite sure what they're condemning, at least in the case of the Bush-Sharon agreement. Because when they condemn an agreement to withdraw from occupied territory in the Gaza Strip, they are, if you like, condemning an agreement to do what they've been calling for many years. This is quite a gamble, both on the part of Ariel Sharon and of George Bush in coming out openly and supporting it. And I think the big question is whether it's really going to happen. And I think European leaders realize that, and they don't want to be on the wrong side of criticizing something that could, in the end, produce a good outcome.
All right. We're going to have a chance to go a little bit further on this. We have to step away, take a short break. We're coming back, Connection listeners, to talk more with Bill Emmett about the European perspective of what's unfolding in the Middle East, though we'd also like to hear from you. As you look at the news this weekend of the targeted assassination of Rantisi, as well as news last week of George Bush, in effect, siding with the Israeli plan for a withdrawal, not just from Gaza, but plans that would leave Israeli settlements in parts of the West Bank and perhaps hold off the long-talked-about idea of a right of return for Palestinian refugees. Lots going on in a diplomatic and street sense there. 1-800-423-8255 to join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Certainly when you look at the historical way that outside support or criticism of the Middle East conflict has been expressed, there's been very mixed messages coming from Europe. And I want to go back for half a sec with Bill Emmett, editor of The Economist. And Bill, you spoke about the position that Tony Blair expressed when he joined President Bush in America late last week. It was quite unqualified support from Mr. Blair at a time when, once again, it doesn't necessarily seem that he's expressing a widely held view in Britain. Help me make sense of that.
Well, I think that Tony Blair has taken the view that he should support George Bush, not obviously absolutely regardless of what he does, but by and large he should be shoulder and shoulder with him in public and try to influence him in private. What we can't tell, of course, as outsiders, is what he's saying in private and what influence he's having. And there's a lot of scepticism in Britain about whether he really has as much influence as he says he has. But he is taking political risks with this support. And so I think that we can assume that he broadly believes the position that he's declaring. I think that the reality of the Bush-Sharon agreement last week is one that Tony Blair understands, which is that it is not a change of American policy.
Right.
What the change is that it's being done in public more than before, but this is basically the position that Bill Clinton got to in 2000 at his Camp David sessions with Yasser Arafat and Ehud Barak, Mr. Sharon's predecessor, predecessor but one, when precisely this sort of deal was what was on the table. Indeed, Palestinian negotiators had agreed to the principle that some of the settlements in the West Bank would be kept in response, exchange for some land swaps. So I think Tony Blair understands that and thinks that while it would be better to have the Palestinians at the table negotiating, nevertheless, this kind of unilateral way is maybe the only option at the moment.
Can I ask you to just go back with me about 18 months, Bill, though, to a time when Tony Blair was being pummeled from a number of different quarters about his support for the American intention to begin a war in Iraq? Because if I'm not mistaken, at that time, Blair's notion, either stated or unstated, was, look, it's probably a good idea to stand shoulder to shoulder with George Bush in Iraq. And if I give him that, I may be able to sort of soften his unilateral ideas in the Middle East and by extension, the unilateral notions of Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. That's the part that I'm thinking back on that appears to have changed.
Well, I think that his position 18 months ago, as you correctly characterize it, I think he felt that dealing with Iraq would then make it easier to have more attention devoted to Israel and Palestine. It would also change the strategic situation in the region, particularly for Israel, and that would mean progress would take place. He will have been pleased when the Aqaba summit took place in the summer of 2003 after the war in Iraq, thought that progress was taking place, but then it all crumbled. And now I think he sees himself as not really having a lot more influence over the process. I mean, the trouble with the Israeli-Palestine conflict is that really only America seems able to have any influence on either side. Whatever anyone else says, certainly in Europe, including Britain, doesn't seem to count for much on any side. And therefore, his only hope is to try to pressure America. Now, this unilateral policy is, though, a unilateral withdrawal policy. It's not a unilateral invasion policy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think you shouldn't see them in the same breath, really, or the same kind of word as the unilateralism of Iraq.
All right. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to have you join our conversation this hour about changes in the Middle East. Let's go to Tel Aviv. Ari Shavit is joining us. He is a columnist for Haaretz, has been with us a number of times before on the program. Ari, nice to have you back.
Nice to be back.
The international work, by some accounts, is done for Ariel Sharon, and now he has to turn his attention to local politics in Israel, selling the idea for the withdrawal from Gaza, a more limited withdrawal from the West Bank. Is that how you see it?
Well, that's part of it. Definitely the battle ahead for him is winning the internal referendum within his party, the Likud party. But over what seemed to be quite difficult only a few days ago seems to be quite easy now, as he won the support of most of the important other leaders of the Likud party, especially Mr. Netanyahu. So I think Mr. Sharon is heading for victory in the internal debate as well.
And on that point specifically, does he get that support from Netanyahu and other right-wing leaders because he's willing to continue with the policy of targeted killings or assassinations, whatever you want to call them, in the West Bank? I'm thinking most specifically of the killing of Rantisi on Saturday.
No, I think that the targeting of Francisi helps him with internal politics. It's not the decisive factor. Of course, it has, so to speak, the side benefit from his point of view of really winning support of hardline supporters, proving to them that he didn't get too soft and it's still him, and withdrawal is not to be carried out in the context of defeat, but rather of victory, of a tough Israeli stance. But I think that really, if you're talking about the Rantisi killing itself and the Yassin killing before it, it's not only cynical politics with the Israeli constituency, it's really what was mentioned before. It's a very deep concern that the withdrawal would not be perceived as Israeli defeat. I mean, the trauma for most Israelis, definitely for right-wing Israelis, is the unilateral withdrawal from Lebanon, which was a success, most people agree, but some argue that it had a part in bringing about the Intifada, the Palestinian-Israeli war, actually, a few months later. If you want to prevent that, right-wing Israelis believe, you have to do something that would prove, not only to Israelis, but to Palestinians as well, that you are not running away. And this is what both Mr. Sharon and the Israeli military are trying to do right now.
And what's the effect, Ari, in Israel, just among ordinary people, of the lineup of international foreign ministers, the UK, the French, the Italians, the Russians, the Japanese, the Australians? They're all saying, you know, once again, these types of targeted killings are unlawful and unacceptable. How is that heard in Israel?
I must say that when it comes to the killing of Mr. Rantisi, there are not many Israelis who would take this kind of condemnation very seriously, especially coming from such countries as Russia or China. Mr. Rantisi, I think that every Israeli checkpoint in the West Bank is much more disturbing from a moral point of view than the Rantisi killing. So when there is criticism of Palestinian mothers cannot get through in checkpoints, most Israelis, even if they don't accept it, they listen to it. When it comes to fighting people like Mr. Rantisi, whose record is just unbelievable, really, when Israelis hear this kind of condemnation, they lose their respect for the moral standards of the international community.
Ari, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Ari Shavit is a columnist for Haaretz, joining us there on the line from Tel Aviv. Back to Bill Emmett in the studio in London. Bill is editor of The Economist. It seems in many ways, Bill, that Ariel Sharon has placed himself in a position through force of will, force of character, and the willingness to take some of these chances. He's really put himself in the catbird seat when it comes to making decisions about what comes next in the Middle East. He's well ahead of any other international quartets or peace processes or roadmaps. He's in charge.
He's certainly in charge now of what goes on the Israeli side. And he's, I think, perhaps for the first time in his prime ministership, he's got an opportunity to get a sort of moral high ground if he wins this vote in the Likud on the withdrawal from Gaza and actually does it. That's good for him. On the other hand, he's not in control of the terrorism, and his nightmare perhaps is that he does all of this and then the terrorism continues or even gets worse, because of course the trouble with his unilateral approach, while it is brave, the trouble with it is that there is no other side to negotiate with at the moment, and that's partly his own doing by demonizing Yasser Arafat. And there's no control of any kind over what the Palestinians are going to do.
Our number's 1-800-423-8255. Take our first call from Bill. Bill's in Northborough, Massachusetts. Bill, thanks for calling.
Good morning, Dick. this decision is disgraceful. I mean,
this is the Bush decision you're talking about?
The Bush decision. It flouts international law. It demonstrates clearly that we aren't and have never been honest brokers. It definitely demonstrates that Blair is nothing more than Bush's poodle. And by extension, I might also add that Blair, if he really thinks that he's influencing Bush, is not just simply a poodle, but self-delusional. And also,
let me just sort of stick with the main thrust here, Bill, because my guest Bill Emmett is saying that these, you know, that the decision to finally end the right of return as something which is going to be negotiated, the decision to say, well, all right, certain settlements are going to remain a part of the West Bank. Bill Emmett says these are things which were negotiated and agreed upon in Camp David, that it's really not a big shift in substance, more just in symbolic terms.
If I may just interject there, not so much the right of return. The right of return was on the table, but it was still being negotiated about.
Okay,
the Palestinians didn't agree to that.
Thanks, Bill.
Yeah, let me point out that there's a double standard here, to say nothing of a large element of hypocrisy. If Jews have the right of return, why can't Palestinians have the right of return? I mean, let's get back to original basics here. The establishment of Israel and everything that's happened since then has missed one major ingredient, and that is any sense of justice. I mean, how do you justify a land grab because a couple of people, say, thousands of years ago owned the land and they decided now that their great ancestors have a right to claim it in the future?
Well, Bill, what are you talking about, 1948? Or are you talking about the decision that was made late last week?
Everything that has come from that particular point has been the major problem. Palestinians feel that they have been wronged and have continued to be wronged, and I can't say that I blame them. I see nothing that suggests that they've been treated fairly in any way, shape, form, or manner.
I want to turn to Bill Emmett on you know, how the Palestinian place has changed at the table from a time when Yasser Arafat was feted in Washington to the last 2 years, where he is basically living in the rubble of former headquarters in Ramallah. Is that simply a result of the Intifada, Bill Emmett? Simply a result of a decision to continue either active or tacit support of suicide bombings at a time when the entire world was focusing on an end to terrorism?
I think it's been the result of the divisions within the Palestinian side between terrorist elements and negotiating elements. And Arafat made the mistake, from his point of view, of seeking to back both sides and thereby losing the trust of outsiders, including, it's fair to say, I think, quite a lot of the Arab leaders around. But I think it was a mistake on the American side and the Israeli side to reject him wholly as the potential leader of the Palestinians, because by if you like, exposing the fact that he was backing both sides and rejecting him, it then meant that we had nobody to negotiate with at all. And I think that in retrospect, demonizing Arafat has been a big mistake, because it's just left a civil war to go on within the Palestinian side.
So in imagining a two-state solution, would there ever be someone sitting on the Palestinian side of the table actively negotiating that side of the two states? Or has the unilateral sort of role of the United States and Israel moved to a point where it's going to be very difficult to get back to that point?
Well, I think it is very difficult to get back to that point. They have demonized Arafat, and then they've hoped that other leaders would come along to fill his place. Several prime ministers have come and gone, each of whom was, as it were, the hope of the future, and then a few days later they resigned. Mm-hmm. So far there has not been the emergence of a force to take their place. Now, never say never is a reasonable thing, but the history of the conflict in the Middle East suggests that one shouldn't expect a Palestinian leadership and a unified Palestinian population to emerge anytime soon, I'm afraid.
Let's go to Needham, Massachusetts. Alberto's joining us. Hi, Alberto.
Thank you very much for taking my call. I'll try to be brief, although this is a complex issue. I'd like to take issue with your statement, Dick, that this has been seen in much of the Arab world. How this has been seen in much of the Arab world, When we deal with the Arab world, I think we have to pay more attention to deeds.
Are you talking about the killing of Rantisi? Are you talking about the U.S. Support of the withdrawal plan?
Both.
Okay.
I like to suggest that, for example, King Abdullah II of Jordan came to meet with Prime Minister Sharon of Israel about 2 weeks before Sharon went to Washington. King Abdullah came by helicopter to Sharon's ranch in Israel, and the official statement was that they discussed Sharon's proposal to pull out of Gaza. But it's reasonable to assume that their discussion went deeper than that.
You're suggesting that at the level of presidents and prime ministers that there may in fact be agreement among neighboring Arab nations for the move that Sharon is making?
Very much so. And indeed, after the announcement, the support by President Bush of Sharon's proposal to pull out of Gaza and to retain as part of Israel some of the larger communities such as Mahale Adumim, King Abdullah stated that we have to face reality, a reality on the ground.
Alberto, I need you to be quick on this one because we're just coming up to a break. But when you talk about this kind of Arab support, are you saying that it is criticism of Hamas and the type of suicide bombing? Is that what you're saying?
I'd like to go further than that. I'd like to suggest that the Palestinian Authority is delighted with the elimination of people like Sheikh Yassin and Rantisi, because it was their supposed to be their job to eliminate terror from the formal organization of the Palestinian Authority. They didn't do it, and they are delighted to see Israel do the dirty work.
Alberto, I'm going to pick that point up when I come back after the break. I'll be talking further with Bill Emmett. We'll also be joined then by Dennis Ross, director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. It's an interesting point that you raise, and I think draws our attention to the complexity of internal politics on the Palestinian side as well as the Israeli side. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to have you join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. We're talking this hour about the shifting ground in the Middle East, diplomatic, as well as what's happening on the street. James Bennett earlier in the program talked about a combination of the sort of ritualistic anger that followed from the targeted killing of Mr. Rantisi, mixed with the genuine rage that he saw in both Ramallah and in Gaza from Cairo. Mustafa al-Said talked about all the demonstrations that came as a result of that. Our caller, Alberto, says that, in fact, a lot of this anger is not necessarily expressing the true feelings of the Palestinian leadership or the other Arab nations in the area, that, in fact, the idea of moving the Hamas people, marginalizing the Hamas people, may be, in fact, what the rest of the Arab world would like. Bill Emmett is with me. He's editor of The Economist. Bill, what do you make of that idea Alberto's proposing?
I think it's plausible. Certainly it's plausible as far as the views of President Mubarak and King Abdullah of Jordan is concerned, that they would welcome the initiative for a unilateral withdrawal, the beginning of unilateral withdrawals from the occupied territories. They realize that only Sharon, a right-winger, can bring about withdrawal of the settlements. Only a right-winger can, if you like, pull over the Israeli right wing. So they would welcome that much. I'm not sure that they would welcome the targeted killing. Mm-hmm. I'd be very interested in Dennis Ross's view of that later when you have him on the program. But I'd be more surprised at that. And the Palestinian leadership, I think, will have mixed feelings because they are always worried about the popularity of Hamas relative to their own popularity. And this act may have increased the popularity of Hamas rather than reducing it or marginalizing it, as your caller said.
Well, let's go straight to Washington. Dennis Ross is listening in. For those of you not familiar with Mr. Ross, he's director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, had a leading role in the Middle East peace process in the Bush senior and President Bill Clinton administrations. Dennis, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure, always.
Can you speak to the point that Bill just tossed your way about how we make sense of the reaction in the Arab world at the sort of official level as opposed to the street level. I mean, the television pictures, are they deceiving here?
No, I don't think the television pictures are deceiving. And I think you can have a private impulse, which is likely to be the case in terms of the Arab leaderships that Bill was referring to, and even the parts of the Palestinian Authority as well. No one, I can assure you, especially given the people I know quite well out there, is shedding tears over either what has happened to either Yassin or in Ratisi's case, especially because Ratisi had very few friends among those in the Palestinian Authority, to be sure. Mm-hmm. But I think there is a distinction here. The distinction here is what puts you on the defensive. And there's no question that in the immediate aftermath of these killings, those who would like to be focused on peaceful coexistence will find it difficult to find their voice right now. They'll be on the defensive. And I think you have to weigh that against, has Hamas been weakened or not? In the near term, Hamas has not been weakened because the emotional climate in which everything is going to take place is going to make many more people want to identify with Hamas, not because they believe in its philosophy or ideology, but because you're dealing with what is a culture of humiliation. And when they feel like they've been humiliated further, then there's a natural impulse towards defiance in those groups that embody defiance. So in the case of what we're seeing right now, in the near term, I have little doubt that there'll be tremendous defensiveness on the part of the Palestinian Authority, on the part of those who would like to begin to find ways to focus on how the Palestinians actually assume responsibilities in the aftermath of an Israeli withdrawal, but they're not going to be too willing to show themselves any time within the next couple of weeks. The real question is what happens after that from two standpoints. Number one, is Hamas actually weakened? For sure, the leaders are going to be hiding right now and not exposing themselves. That makes it harder for them to plan.
And maybe never identified after this.
Well, I mean, in a sense, there are people out there. You can bet on the fact that the Israelis can identify those that they think are still leaders. But those leaders are going to be spending a whole lot more time focused on their own self-protection than being able to plan and carry out attacks.
Right.
But there's even a larger question in my mind in terms of organization, and that is, do you have figures who command authority? Do you have figures who are somehow emblematic of a cause and who have a kind of symbolic bearing? And I think one of the things that we're going to have to see is whether you see others begin to emerge. Now, if they can't show themselves, it's a little bit harder to take on that kind of a public rallying, mobilizing capacity. And so I suspect that Hamas will be dealt, I think, somewhat of a setback, but then you have to relate that, as I said, to the emotional climate. And ultimately, what is going to matter is, do things change on the ground? My big fear, to be quite honest, is that the gap in time between when Sharon gets what will be a kind of political legal endorsement in Israel, meaning not just the referendum but also the Knesset endorsement, and the actual time that withdrawals take place may be so long that, as we usually see in the Middle East, gaps get filled, and in this case they get filled by violence, and that runs the risk of overwhelming what is, I think, in truth, a revolutionary initiative on the Israeli side. And as Bill was making a reference to, and I think he's quite right, you know, there are many people in the Arab world, at least leaders, might well believe that Sharon is not someone who can make peace with the Palestinians, but he may be necessary for beginning the process and justifying and legitimizing the very idea of evacuating settlements, and being the architect of the settler movement, being the one to do that, makes it much easier for anybody who succeeds him.
Dennis, I want to turn your attention, if I can, to what happened in this country late last week and over the weekend. That is the shift in U.S. policy, Mr. Bush's public endorsement of the Ariel Sharon plan for the withdrawal, but the sort of added and notable riders to that, allowing Israel permanent ownership of certain settlements in the West Bank and an end to the hopes for many Palestinian refugees in places like Lebanon and Jordan who thought that their future was still being negotiated. Let's listen to the way that President Bush put his support for Israel last week.
The United States is strongly committed, and I am strongly committed, to the security of Israel as a vibrant Jewish state. I reiterate our steadfast commitment to Israel's security and to preserving and strengthening Israel's self-defense capability, including its right to defend itself against terror.
Now, these specific points and the changes were put to John Kerry yesterday on NBC's Meet the Press. Let's listen to the way that Tim Russert phrased it for the Democratic leader.
On Thursday, President Bush broke with the tradition and policy of six predecessors when he said that Israel can keep part of the land seized in the 67 Middle East War and asserted that Palestinian refugees cannot go back to their particular homes. Do you support President Bush?
Yes.
Completely?
Yes.
Well, that was the end of that exchange, Dennis Ross. It's almost as if that's a part of the conversation that neither Bush nor Kerry necessarily want to make a large part of the domestic conversation in the United States.
Well, I think that's probably true. But I also, I would like to put this again in a kind of larger perspective. Number one, if you read the Bush letter to Sharon carefully, one of the things you find is that on the border, there is an acknowledgement more in terms of talking about the realities that Israel isn't going to go back to the 1949 armistice lines, which mm-hmm. is really a more artful way of saying you don't have to go back to June 4, 67. And it refers to taking account of new realities, and those new realities are population centers. But specifically, it goes on to say that in any final status agreement, the changes that should be incorporated in the agreement are going to have to be mutually agreed, and those mutually agreed changes should reflect the realities the president's referring to. Now, what that means from a negotiating standpoint is the following. It means nothing can happen unless the Palestinians approve it. So if you're going to, in fact, incorporate some of the words used in the letter, population centers, the word settlement blocks does not appear. If you're going to incorporate some of these areas, it's going to have to be with Palestinian approval, and in all likelihood, that's only going to happen if Palestinians get a swap of territory. Now, let me put this again in some historical frame of reference. At Camp David II, and then again in the Clinton ideas at the end of the administration, we were presenting the concept that the Israelis would annex about 5% of the territory. The Palestinians at Camp David were prepared to accept the principle of three settlement blocks for the Israelis accommodating 80% of the settlers. The difference was not over the principle of three settlement blocks. The difference was over whether or not the precise size would be agreed to at that point. And there was a difference on what the geographic scope would be. So the Palestinians in their own negotiations were prepared to accept that. It was, again, part of a negotiation. That's not what we have right now. But we also have Sharon doing something no Israeli prime minister has ever done before. That is commit to evacuate settlements without getting anything from the Palestinians. So in a sense, you need to put this notion of moving the border around in some perspective. There was never going to be an outcome where there wasn't going to be an adjustment of the border.
Right.
On the issue of refugees, I would also simply say what Bush says is offered as an observation. And he says the just fair solution to this is going to come through the Palestinian state, where refugees should settle there rather than Israel. Now, that doesn't mean that they still can't negotiate about some being permitted to go back. It doesn't mean that there can't be compensation for those who choose not to. So there's still a scope for negotiation, and what he's saying, in effect, is a reality. If you believe in a two-state solution, if there's a right of return for Palestinian refugees to Israel, that means you believe not in a two-state solution, but a one-state solution.
If I can just turn this to Bill Emmett, though. Bill, it does seem, if we look at the present realities that the Bush administration is facing, that Bush has simply taken the urgency of involving his government in Mideast affairs and left the concentration on Iraq rather than in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv or Ramallah or Gaza. But he's sort of stepped back away from it in a way that allows him to concentrate on Iraq. Is that a reasonable reading of it?
Well, I think it's true that since last summer or early autumn, there has been too little attention by the administration on Israel and Palestine. There has been no serious sort of shuttle diplomacy. There has been no serious effort to bring back some sort of a negotiation, but also quite possibly there wasn't much hope of it anyway, because of the violence that was taking place, because there wasn't really a Palestinian side able to negotiate. So I think that this endorsement of Sharon's position is, as Dennis Ross says, actually an endorsement of quite a remarkable initiative, one that is attention from the White House and represents that. Now the question is what happens after this and whether or not attention from the White House can be focused also on getting some of the other Arab leaders involved in trying to get the Palestinians back to the negotiating table, perhaps to fill that gap that Dennis Ross quite rightly says is a very dangerous one between this being endorsed legally and actually happening.
And Dennis, we're close to the end of the program, so a quick last question for you. When you sit and look at one set of negotiations, it's these days it seems very difficult to separate what's going on in the Arab-Israeli conflict with the anger and support for the insurgents that the Iraqis have over in the other battle that the U.S. is directly involved with. So does the U.S. need to say, gosh, let's make sure we don't do something over here that's going to make that battle any worse?
Well, yeah, I would say that in some respects there's a connection only in terms of the emotional climate,
right.
But in a very practical sense there's not. If you make headway between Israelis and Palestinians, it may improve the climate in the region as a whole and make it easier for some Arab leaders to be more responsive to you in Iraq. And the same in Iraq. If you make headway there, it makes it, again, it affects a climate. But let me just make one quick point on something that Bill made or offered. I think it's critical for the administration now. What I would have liked to have seen them do at the same time that they were talking to the Israelis is to be talking to everybody else, including especially the Palestinians. The fact is, by excluding the Palestinians, they made the Palestinian response, even before the killing of Rantisi, bound to be negative. And when the Palestinian response is negative, then it's also going to affect the tone of everybody else. So I think it's critical, even though it's not going to be so easy in the next couple of weeks because of what's happened with Rantisi, the administration needs to be talking in a systematic way to the Palestinians, because there still is a reality. Israel is going to get out, and somebody has to assume control, and it's better to have the people who believe in coexistence be the ones who do it.
Dennis, we're out of time. I want to thank you for being with us.
Pleasure.
Dennis is director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and author of a forthcoming book, Missing Peace. It's a comprehensive look at the Middle East peace process. Bill Emmett, thanks so much for being with us.
Great pleasure.
Bill is editor of The Economist and author most recently of 2021 Vision, 20th Century Lessons for the 21st Century. We also had with us on the program James Bennett, Mustafa Al-Sayed, and Ari Shavit. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.